year. These proposed levy reductions will put $500 million a year back into the New Zealand economy and contribute towards keeping the cost of living down. This government has turned ACC around from the dire state with record losses that Labor left it in. A boost in rehabilitation rates has been one of the major reasons for the turnaround. Savings in administration costs have also contributed. ACC is now on target to be a fully funded, securing the future of our 24/7 no-faults accident insurance scheme. The proposed levy on wage and salary earners is reduced by 17%. This saves households $340 million a year, or $170 a year, for someone on the average wage. The proposed levy on employers and self-employed is reduced by 22%. This reduces costs for businesses by $247 million a year. For a typical Kiwi small business with 7 employees, this would have been a saving of $1,120 per year. I'm now going to ask Nick to make a few further comments, and we'll take any questions you might have in relation to ACC, and then we'll come back to the balance of the press conference. Nick, on your hands.
Thanks, Prime Minister. These levy reductions for workers and businesses are significant and are possible because of the improved state of ACC's finances. After the massive losses of $2.4 billion in 2007 and $4.8 billion in 2008, ACC has delivered consistent surpluses of about $2.5 billion per year. The overall solvency of the scheme is now at 72%, which is its best ever. The reason we can afford these levy reductions in both the earners and workers' account is that both are set to reach 100% solvency in the next year. The solvency in the motor vehicle account is at 66% but improving. It is proposed that the licence fee and petrol tax remain unchanged next year, which will also help in keeping inflation down. If we maintain ACC's current financial performance in 3 years' time, there will be room for levy reductions for motorists. The big improvements ACC has made that enable these levy reductions are to the rehabilitation rates and the better management of costs. Income compensation is ACC's biggest ticket item. We have 20% fewer people on accident compensation than 3 years ago because of the success of programs to get people back to work more quickly. ACC's costs were out of control between 2005 and 2008 when they grew by 50%, or from $2 billion a year to $3 billion a year. We've reduced claim costs by $450 million a year, or about 15%. $200 million of that saving is in the income compensation. $60 million is in the changes that we made to physiotherapy. $16 million in administration costs. $12 million in the hearing changes, $8 million in elective surgery. It is these cost savings that we're now in a position to be able to pass on to both households and businesses. I do want to acknowledge the very hard work and a pretty difficult job that both the board and the staff of ACC has done that has enabled us to be able to pass these benefits on to households and businesses.
Isn't it actually the case that people are being declined ACC rather than
No, I don't accept that, and it's interesting if you look at that report that was provided at the Select Committee, only 4% of people that were coming off ACC were going on to welfare benefits, and half of those were going on to the unemployment benefit, suggesting that they were work ready. Secondly, if you look at that very steep increase, was there a 50% increase in the number of accidents between 2005 and 2008? No, there was not. Costs got out of control, and effectively you've seen a $1 billion increase in the claim costs, and with the savings measures that we've taken, pulling back about a third of that.
Aren't you just taking back some of the businesses that you had over the last couple of years, where you installed in New Zealand building in 2009 and saying that the cost of the average family of ACC rises was going to be $315 a year. So, okay, it's come down, but...
Well, it's actually pretty simple, Guy. if ACC is making $4.8 billion losses, levies inevitably are going to have to go up. If ACC is well managed and is providing surpluses, then government's got the room to reduce those levies.
So, if you go back to when you first became minister, is the average family going to be paying less or more under these changes?
If you look at for the earner rate that workers pay, that was back at $1.70 and is effectively coming back to that. If you look in terms of the account for businesses, I think it was about $1.24 and is now coming back to $1.15 per $100 of earnings.
So when you take into account the rises in motor vehicle registration and other things, your average Kiwi is still paying more in ACC levies than when you came in as minister?
Oh, effectively. ACC's costs were out of control. This government had to increase the levies as well as make a whole lot of other changes to stop it just accumulating more and more debt. We've now got that debt under control, and that gives us the capacity to be able to pass on the benefits of that prudent financial management back to levy payers. The alternative would have been to bank the savings and the benefits before you got them. I think that would not be prudent management, and that is why I think the changes that we've made have been in the right order. That is, get your costs under control, and when you do, then pass those benefits on to families and businesses.
So you take $8 million in elective surgery. How is savings being made there, apart from saying to people you're not having an operation that you might have been able to previously?
Yeah, well, let's take a detailed look at elective surgery. And $8 million of that saving is from the elective surgery. We saw elective surgery costs go from $90 million a year to $240 million a year. Now, does anybody really believe that that was because there was a huge increase in the number of accidents? No. There's this grey zone between what is fairly a cost from an accident and what is a health cost. And ACC was effectively becoming a de facto health insurer. And what we're saying as a government is ACC is about providing cover for accidents. The number of elective surgeries that ACC will fund this year will be higher than every year bar those beyond 2007-08, where it did grow out of control. And like I say, effectively, ACC was funding surgery that was not accident related.
So you don't accept that anyone who has a valid ACC claim is now not getting it?
Well, when ACC deals with 1.4 million claims per year, there is always going to be examples. And for instance, on the 1st of July, we made changes to the review system to improve it by making it completely independent of ACC to improve the integrity of that system. What I can reassure claimants is that this government is absolutely committed to those people that have genuine accident claims getting the surgery, getting the rehabilitation, and getting the income compensation that they deserve.
What about sexual abuse? You know, there was a lot of talk at the time about people who maybe having promised counselling or who thought that they would be eligible then and then found that they weren't. What do you say to people who, under the old scheme, might have had expectations?
Oh, there has been some difficulties, and that's why I did an independent review of the way in which ACC was managing sensitive claims. Dr. Barbara Disley was appointed to do that review. She most recently produced a report in April which gave ACC a very positive report and said that it was managing the issue of those very sensitive claims well.
In a turnaround from a 4.8 billion deficit to a 2.5 surplus, how much of it was attributed to the sorts of changes you've outlined today? How much was improvement in the investment account and in various other ways that ACC measures?
Yeah, good question. Let me just try and give you a parallel there. The first thing is, of that $4.8 billion loss that ACC made in the 2008-09 year, not $1 of that was from investment losses. Labor has sort of spun that line for some excuse for their pretty poor management. It was all about the huge increase in liabilities. And the simple way that I would explain it is this. During the term of the last government, the number of people on ACC income compensation was growing by 700 per year. They were predicting that by 2020, the numbers on ACC compo would grow from 13,000 to 20,000. That had a horrific impact on the liabilities of the corporation. Since we've been the government, rather than it going up by 700 per year, it's actually been dropping by 1,000 a year. Now that's as a consequence of a pretty big investment, pretty intensive, around those people that are on long-term compo. and that has delivered that reduction, and that really is at the heart of how the government is able to provide these pretty big reductions in levies for both workers and for businesses.
So what about the investment side, though? How's that performing?
Well, if you look at ACC's investments in the last financial year, the 2010-11 financial year, ACC has made higher levels of return on its investments than we expected, above budget, but that has been completely offset by the drop in interest rates and the impact on the liabilities. So in the last year, financial factors, both the decline in interest rates and the better than average returns on investments, has completely balanced out. Just to explain that some more, if the interest rates drop, the amount of capital that ACC needs to meet its future liabilities increases quite substantially. So those financial factors in the last year have actually completely balanced each other out. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Just in terms of ministerial activity, I'm in Wellington today, tomorrow. On Thursday, I'm in Christchurch, and Friday in Auckland. Next Monday evening, I leave for the United States. Also this week, Australian Treasurer Wayne Swan is in town on Thursday for talks, and we'll be meeting Bill English, as well as holding a joint press conference. When the House resumes tomorrow, the government intends to make further progress on the Watertight Homes Resolution Service, financial assistance amendment package, subordinate legislation, the electoral amendment bill, the smoke-free environments amendment bill, and other bills on the order paper. Questions?
Prime Minister, what is your reaction to the ACT Party ad and its claim that National is pandering to Māori radicals, and are you able to work with Dr. Branch?
Well, I mean, we would reject those claims. I think what we have done is put race relations on a good footing in New Zealand. I think we've tried to work constructively. I think we acknowledge that there's work to be done. But I think most New Zealanders have supported the positive step that we have taken. There'll always be those that are frustrated with the process. We accept that. And there'll always be those that ask about the relevancy of the treaty, 170-odd years since it was signed. But I mean, the government has its responsibilities. They're well set out by the law in New Zealand, and I think we're following that through. In terms of can we work with Don Brash, the answer is yes. There's nothing really new in any of the comments he's making.
Do you think people listening to his message?
No. I mean, look, frankly, the ads in the papers are not factually correct. In my view, they don't represent what's actually happening. And New Zealanders have a chance to sort of see what we're doing. I think that we've been working very constructively. We're dealing with the treaty settlement process as quickly and speedily as we can. We accept people want to see that completed. We also know that there are plenty of areas where there's been significant Māori underachievement. We need to do better. But I don't think any of that's particularly favouring Māori. I think it's in New Zealand's interest to have less Māori on the benefit or less Māori in prison, and we'll be going to continue to work on those programs.
So you
think he's raising money? It's his money. Well, at least some fund his money, so they're free to do whatever they like, but at the end of the day, everyone knows there's an election coming up, so they can probably guess why the ads are there.
So in a coalition with him, you wouldn't listen to these arguments or put any of them into operation?
Well, we all sit down and have discussions with our partners, but I don't think there's anything that's new there in the way that they propose it. They made all the same claims about the coastal area and marine bill. If you go and have a look at, I think it was number one in the ad when I briefly sort of looked at it on Saturday, was something about, that is going to give much greater rights and easier access to customary title effectively in coastal area and marine bill. Well, that's factually incorrect. The bill actually codifies the list of tests that need to be met. Tony Harawira left the Maori Party because he thought it was so hard for Maori to achieve those tests, so they both can't be right.
How difficult will it be to manage a government with both the Maori Party and the ACT Party in it?
Well, I don't think it's as difficult as some may think, and that's the reason for that is the way I see these sort of coalition arrangements working, or confidence and supply agreements working, is that the Maori Party has a relationship with National, and the ACT Party has a relationship with National, and actually at the moment United Future has a relationship with National. That doesn't mean that they have a relationship with each other. I mean, frankly, yep, there are always going to be differences, and sometimes quite significant differences, when you have parties from the left and right forming a deal with a party that's in the centre like National. It's not any easier for Labour. I mean, you can't tell me that New Zealand First and the Greens are a happy marriage together.
Speaking of New Zealand First,
not really, thanks.
You've talked about the relationship of New Zealand First, you disagree with it for various reasons.
Yeah.
Is there some reason why you would have a different view about
No, I mean, there's a wide variety of reasons why we ruled New Zealand First out. None of those have changed and made our position clear. New Zealand voters know where we stand and they get a chance to make the decisions of how they want to see the makeup of government when they go to the polls on November 26th. Well, I mean, I don't want to get into bottom line, and I don't think actually, in fairness to the ACT Party, they do either, or other political parties. I think there's a maturity that's being demonstrated by most political parties these days, but I don't think it's in the country's interest to go and revisit that. As far as I'm concerned, I think we've now got a fairer situation than was in place when the foreshore and seabed legislation was there. I mean, in my mind, a major change that came from the removal of the foreshore and seabed legislation, the replacement of the coastal area and marine bill, was that Maori had their chance to test their rights in court if they can't reach an agreement with the government. And actually, as I said, the test is set out in legislation. Outside that, it's very similar to the foreshore and seabed legislation.
Do you have a view on whether this had any impact on whether you'll come to an accommodation around the Epsom?
No, I mean, we'll have those discussions in due course with the ACT Party when we're in the process of selecting our candidate at the moment. I think that happens in the next week or so.
If the National Party would have benefited from the politics of racial polarisation, would that concern you at all?
Well, look, you know, the New Zealand public will choose to vote on whatever basis that they see fit. I'm, as a political leader, intend to take our message to the country on November 26th. I believe the 3 years that we've been in office has demonstrated the kind of government we are, the sort of leadership we bring to issues, the sort of values and principles that underpin our party, and the future aspirations we have for New Zealand. And in the end, I'll leave for the voters to decide what's the government they want.
There's been a lot of comments about Labor's proposals before now. There's a lot of mainstream economic commentary which supports a capital gains tax. Do you accept that there's a legitimate economic argument why capital gains tax should be
Well, I think the first question you ought to go back to and ask is, does New Zealand need another tax? And the answer to that is no. Not if you follow National's plan. You're going to be back in surplus within 3 years. You'll have debt topping out under 30% of GDP. I think we'll have created the better part of 170,000 jobs. We're in a position where the economy is growing and where it can afford its liabilities. And in my view, why do you want to put another tax on the economy, which is frankly just a dagger through the heart of growth? I can't see the point in that. Secondly, I don't actually accept the view that New Zealand doesn't have a capital gains tax. It does. Yes, it's not as comprehensive as some jurisdictions, but actually if one goes and looks at those jurisdictions, you'll see that there are a lot of differences, actually. I mean, they are all purist in the way they're delivered, and actually the interaction between the personal and company rates in New Zealand is quite subtle. And actually, if you go and have a look at it, in the last, both Budget 2011 and Budget 2012, a considerable number of changes were made by National. Labor's actually fighting a problem they had when they were in office, but not actually the problem that exists today. I think you go and ask people who have been buying and selling properties, or buying and selling shares, and selling them probably anything in under 5 years, whether they've had a knock on the door from the IRD Department.
So have you answered the question about $550,000 as a global salary when you get taxed on that?
Yeah. Yeah, because it depends on what your intent was and depends on what asset you particularly bought. But if you bought an investment property, you would have been renting that property and in the business of renting properties for a considerable period of time. If you didn't, you probably breached your intent rules. So, look, I think if you go and have a look at the overall mix of taxes we have in New Zealand, and the integrity of that tax system under National, all I can tell you is the system is a lot better, a lot less complex, and more likely to deliver revenue. Yep, in the very long term, of course, you can always put new taxes on. But if the answer to New Zealand is more taxes, then New Zealanders better get used to lower growth and lower wage growth and less jobs. Because in the end, this is just another sianka on the economy that's being proposed by Labor because they want to spend more money, and in the end, they've got to square the circle. And the answer to that is put another tax on New Zealanders.
Aren't those incentives only if you sell it within 2 years?
No, that's not right. No. And by the way, if you want to go and ask the person in New Zealand who is probably the most proficient in understanding the tax system in New Zealand, go and ask Robin Oliver, the head of tax policy at IRD. He's vehemently opposed to capital gains tax.
So what if you buy a rental property then? What's the intention of renting it out? But you sell it. So you don't have the intention at the start of making capital gains. You sell it, you make a capital gain. that's an income.
Correct, but you have to prove to IRD that that was genuinely what your intent was.
But if you're talking about adding taxes to the New Zealand economy, the national government actually did that by increasing GST, didn't it? And well, I appreciate it's fiscally neutral,
yeah,
but that's exactly what Labour is proposing as well, to do a fiscally neutral.
No, it's not. Labour's not going to be fiscally neutral.
Well, it's taking tax-free off the first 5,000.
Yeah, let's wait and see when we see the numbers next this week.
While we're on subject to tax...
I bet you it won't be. They'll be out there spending more money and basically putting another tax on.
Well,
but in the end, they only know how to do one thing, these guys, and that is tax the economy more and spend more. You wait and see.
Australia is also looking to increase its, I think it's 18,000.
Yeah, it's looking to put a multi-billion dollar ETS on its economy. So, yeah, it's giving repayments through a higher tax-free threshold, and it's taking billions and billions of dollars off people through the ETS.
So do you think that's a bad thing potentially for their economy, and it could affect people in New Zealand?
No, I think it's a matter for them, but my point is they are raising a hell of a lot of revenue. So, you know, I could go around tomorrow and raise a hell of a lot of revenue and then bring in a tax-free threshold. I'm not taking the pressure off the New Zealand economy. If you want New Zealand to grow and to attract investment, you need a low tax, fair regime with integrity. We don't need another new tax in New Zealand. We need more taxpayers in New Zealand. And the answer from Labor is this one. If you are a top personal taxpayer, your tax is going up, you'll certainly pay more in capital gains tax, and frankly, you're not welcome in New Zealand. Well, they can campaign on that and good luck. But from my perspective, that's not the way we see things going.
Wouldn't that leave the opportunity of lowering income taxes and corporate taxes, though, if you wanted to engage in this type of trade-off, which was identical to the one that you did with GST?
Well, people could do that, but in our view, that's not going to be where they go.
No, it's where you could go, though.
Well, we don't want to. We're happy with the tax system in New Zealand. We have aligned the top personal rate with the trust rate. We've aligned the top savings rate with the corporate rate. We don't have exemptions to GST. We have a great system with good integrity. People are not spending their life with tax accountants. I'll tell you now, go and think through all the things these people are talking about. So if they are going to have a valuation on every new asset, if they're going to include assets you currently own, then somewhere along the line, every New Zealander is going to have to value every asset that's included in this. Well, good luck with that one.
So
that's the starting point, and it only gets worse. So
the rest of the world somehow, which stumbles along with a capital gains tax, is wrong, and you're right.
But the rest of the world, all of them have different quirks in the system. They're entitled to have their design. What I'm telling you is I'm happy with our design. A lot of those countries don't have GST that's comprehensive across the system. A lot of them don't have imputation between personal taxes and between company taxes. A lot of them have very different rules around deductibility of their company expenses. They are all different. But the argument somehow that New Zealand doesn't have a capital gains tax is wrong. What you can do is extend that and put another tax on if you want to. We don't want it.
In relation to the gift duty, the abolition of gift duty, which is in the taxation amendment bill, before Parliament, the Institute of Chartered Accountants has warned that may open up widespread tax avoidance and novel forms of tax avoidance which haven't really been thought through.
Well, the advice from the officials is that's wrong. And again, if you go back and have a look at gift duty, I think it raised less than about $1 million. And the administration costs.
The Institute for Chartered Accountants don't believe that. So, I mean, isn't it really?
Well, we tested that through all of the officials for obvious reasons. And the advice we had was that the amount of revenue it raised was tiny, the administration cost of it was very high, and the probability of it being able to be used to game the system, if you like, wasn't there. And I'd advise you to take it up with Peter Dunn if you don't believe me, but he's got all the advice from the officials.
The advice from the officials is extremely thin, actually. It's a few pages long and hardly comprehensive.
Yeah, well, sometimes one word's enough to give you an answer. It's around the pages.
This is a tax cut, essentially, for the wealthy in terms of...
No, it's not.
$70 million of compliance costs.
That's right. See, we raised $1 million for $70 million worth of compliance costs.
But that's only wealthy people putting money into trusts, trying to protect assets from creditors and so forth.
Well, all that was tested out, and I asked those questions myself, so don't think that's
what do you think of the rate that Australia struck for its carbon price, and does this make it inevitable that we'll have to end our half obligation when it expires at the end of next year?
Well, in terms of the latter part of the question, no. We're going through the review at the moment, and when we've had an opportunity to look at that review, we can determine what the next steps are for New Zealand. I haven't actually seen that review, so no, I don't think it does actually mean that we have to halve or restore our half obligation to a full obligation. In terms of the cost, what it shows is that New Zealand's system's pretty good value. I mean, Australia's estimates are it's about $500 a household. New Zealand's running at about $160 a household. I mean, just looking at their scheme at the very top level, it looks like there's quite a lot of comparability in terms of the main manufacturing sectors. So that's good. I mean, I think one of the reasons we wanted to have similarity across the Tasman is we didn't want large emitters, the aluminium smelters and the likes, moving location. We've got a very integrated and unified trans-Tasman trading market solely for the purposes of climate change legislation. I think we've largely achieved that.
That's a pretty big price difference. It could almost be an incentive for a polluter to move to New Zealand
and get cheaper. Well, the reason in Australia, though, is you've got to look at the makeup of emissions. So New Zealand's half of all of our emissions came from agriculture. In Australia, it's largely coal. So what's driving up the price is that the coal-powered energy is really paying a significant burden in their ETS proposal. Yes, they could come to New Zealand if they want to, and then they would largely be getting electricity which comes from renewables. And in terms of what we've seen as the result of the ETS, every new application we've had from electricity generation has come from a renewable.
So why haven't you seen this review yet? Why haven't you seen the ETS review result yet? I mean, they reported a few weeks ago.
Oh, well, we're working our way through it. I haven't seen it.
Do you know the time frame on them?
Soon, but I don't know exactly when.
The budget figures are based on that obligation going reversion to full obligation. So yep. You can't really afford not to restore to full obligation.
That's an assumption I wouldn't make if I was you.
Well, why can't you do it? You can't afford up that.
We just have to wait and see the full proposal.
Prime Minister, last Thursday the Leading Businessman League launched a campaign for Pure Advantage, which is trying to get New Zealand on a green growth sort of track, and yep. Also to get us back to the top of league tables around environmental. At that launch, there was about five Labour MPs and a few Green Party representatives, but nobody from the National Party. It seems quite peculiar that your natural allies are calling on you to turn green.
Oh, look, I don't know anything about it. All I can tell you is the government's been looking at areas where we can work with business. We've got a group, I think, set up by Phil O'Reilly that's looking at that issue in terms of green initiatives.
Well, you've set up that group in response to the entreaties from us groups.
Well, I don't know if that's the same thing you're talking about. I don't know that particular thing that you're talking about.
No, Pure Advantage is set up by Stephen Tindall and Jeremy Moon and so forth. They would have invited you, I would expect, to their function.
I don't run my own diary. I don't know where I was at this. I think Hamilton from memory.
Nikki Kaye turns up for just about everything that happens in North Zealand.
Well, she should be congratulated.
And she's a blue-greener. She didn't turn up for this function. I mean, you say that...
Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't run everyone's diary. We're not going to run post-cabinet presser going with me going through every single thing of every person's diary. If you want to take it up those offices, go and take it up.
Another question. A group of leading New Zealand business want your government to be more attentive towards green issues than you currently are.
Well, I think we're doing quite a lot. We've got an emissions trading scheme that's in place. It's working effectively. We've got a group that's set up to look at those issues. I think we're making progress.
Can I ask another issue? Indonesian authorities intercepted, I think,
yes.
78 asylum seekers from Sri Lanka who were on their way here on Saturday. Have you had any briefings on that?
I have had a briefing. I mean, there are some indications that may have been heading towards New Zealand, although they haven't been absolutely confirmed. I understand that some of those asylum seekers are holding up New Zealand flags or signs that they might want to go to New Zealand. And our very simple message to them is they're not welcome.
Do you know what will happen
to them? I don't. I think the Indonesian authorities have the Indonesian Navy intercepted the boat, and it's been tied up in port in Indonesia. But what happens from here, I don't know.
So it's tied up in port, and as far as you know, are those asylum seekers still on the boat?
I think they are, but I think the captain and the various other people who were navigating the boat are not, as I understand.
So was it just the New Zealand flags that gave the intelligence that they were coming here?
I think they were holding signs as well, actually.
I mean, that's sort of quite concrete evidence, because there were only sort of about half a dozen other boats that have thought to have tried to want to come here before.
Well, I think it confirms what I've been saying for some time, that it is only a matter of time before large vessels, steel-hulled vessels, capable of navigating their ways in New Zealand or Canberra or far away parts of the world, would try and make their way here. And it's eminently possible this boat was intending to do that. They are the early indications we have, but we can't absolutely confirm that.
So where did your briefing come from? Is that from the Australians or is that from the
Indians? It came from my intelligence people. And so very simple messages, they're not welcome here.
So there's no chance that they'll be let in here under some of our quotas or anything like that?
No. Okay, thanks very much.